Welcome to the last lecture, and almost over. Okay, so today we'll finally see the algorithm of a new development called skydiving. And skydiving is a fancy name, but the solver, you see what I mean, but we call it the dynamical SDP solver. So the paper is still about to appear. But the basic SDP algorithms and navigators, those two papers that you're all familiar with already. And so so today we're really going to get into the details of this algorithm, and you will see a lot of parameters actually. When you are using skydiving algorithm, those parameters, although we try to find the most general value set, the value set should apply to most general scenarios. But those parameters are things that you can adjust and that might improve the performance of your algorithm. So that's why I want to show you the details, like what those parameters means and how they are motivated, so that you know which parts you will be able to tune later on and how you should interpret those tunings. Okay, so today's plan will be first, I'll review a few things of SDBB and the most simple setup of solving the problem we set up. And then I'll discuss some problematic scenarios just using the most naive implementations. And that motivates us to develop more sophisticated algorithms dealing with specific problems that we ran into. And so those parts will be the meat of our algorithms, of the skydiving algorithm. And finally, I'll show you some slides of the results and the performance of the new algorithm. Okay, so now let's first flashback to the setup of an SDP, like how we solve an SDP problem. So we think of the interior point method as solving the Lagrangian with a Lagrange multiplier mu times log determinant x. And there, with respect to the x and the y, so we find the stationary solution with respect to x and y, and that gives us a primal and dual feasibility condition. And finally, if we demand stationarity with respect to x, that gives us optimal condition. Okay, and the interior point methods start mu from a large value and solve those equations while continuously decrease mu at each iteration. And at when mu approaches zero, or at exact optimality, when mu approaches zero, the Lagrangian take the value of the primal objective, which is the same as a dual objective. So the duality gap, as we approach mu equals to zero surface, the gap should also goes to zero. Okay, and so from now on, I will write C to stand for all x and y's just for convenience. And then all three equations can be just simply written down as gradient equals to zero condition.
Is there a reason you have written approximate sign in the limit mu goes to zero equation?
It actually should be equal to each other, yeah. Yeah, and then I want to add a few more comments about mu. So originally the optimal condition should be x equals to y, x times y equals to zero, while x and y are semi-definite positive. But the mu term is penalty term for x for the matrix being not exactly positive. So we use this mu term as a penalty term or a barrier term to keep the solver inside of the positive region. But our ultimate goal is to find the optimal find solutions solving the optimal conditions. That's why we will gradually decrease mu while trying to stay as close inside of the positive coin at each step. So the good thing of having this penalty term is that it forces x and y to stay positive, and since as mu goes to zero, as x and y approach the optimal conditions, x and y become EO conditioned. So keeping a mu there can condition x, y to be regular. Okay. And right, okay, so this page is just, again, notations. And then from now on, I'll use the parameter p, which stands for the physical parameters like scaling dimensions or OP coefficients. Okay, that's just notation. Okay, now, okay, so first of all, this figure is going to show up a lot, and it's potentially very confusing, so interrupt me if you find it very confusing. So this is a 3D plot. In general, the x-axis will stand for p. But here I plot the one when p is just one dimension and equals p stands for delta sigma. Maybe this should be x-axis. But anyway, this axis that's perpendicular to the page stands for c, which is all those x and y's. So this axis is actually very high dimensional. Okay, and the vertical axis stands for the Lagrangian at I draw curves here, but in fact I meant to draw three D surfaces that comes out of the page as well, and each surface like those 3D surfaces will correspond to the Lagrangian at finite mu as a function of both C and P. Okay? And any questions there?
So C are the variables of the Lagrangian instead of the our parameters, right?
Sorry, let me flash back. So those are C's.
Yeah, okay.
And now P, C and B, and B depends on P.
Yeah.
And the mu there, like you change the surface. You change one of the term.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, and here is more or less what the navigator method does, is to fix a P, it tries to find the optimal solutions at this fixed P. So this is C star is optimal solutions at a fixed P. And we do it by starting from a higher mu and some initial conditions of C, and we gradually decrease mu. So this solver is kind of searching the space of perpendicular to this page. That's why I had kind of a disk here, but I just meant to saying it's not a fixed C solving. It's exploring the space like perpendicular.
Solve, you mean find a cosine?
Yeah, that's what SDPB does. Like you fix P and then you keep solving X and Y's and so on. Okay, and so the navigator strategy is to fix a P, reach the mu equals to zero surface, use the local information, derivative information there, to decide where to move next. And after we take that step, we'll come up again and start from the initial conditions with a very large mu and do the same procedure here. Okay, so that's what I'm writing down here. the first line is just descending from higher mu to lower mu, to mu equals to zero, and then we decide which step to take, and then we will start the solver again. Okay, and
so which step of this?
This is an. Well, so for this plot particularly, I only plot delta sigma as so P stands for delta sigma, but this picture should apply to all like general P. Yeah. Okay, and right. So now the question is to reduce the procedures that we have to repeat this from higher mu to lower mu, like can we explore the whole space as explore the functions as a function of both C and P at the same time instead of fix one parameters and solve C along and then move that parameters. So what we want to do is that,
could you explain the equations on the bottom just once? What are those arrows?
So the arrows, I just mean what we are doing with this, the procedures. So the
first line is what was happening just in the navigator, right?
This is what happened in STPP solver. So this is fixed P.
Yeah.
And the C, which is which are X and Ys,
yeah.
They're changing by we're demanding the optimal solution.
Yeah.
And it's descending from large mu to mu equals to zero surface. So that's exactly what the STPP solver does.
And what does the next line mean?
Next line means this, so mu equals to zero is a navigator surface.
Yeah.
So we, according to the derivative information there, we make, either a gradient descent or see Newton's method to decide what's the step to take in parameter space.
So that's the second is the navigator step?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And what's the third line?
The third line is this line, is after deciding a new P.
Yeah.
Because at the end we want to reach a sum, say for example, for this example, we want to see find the minimum of the navigator surface. Then we have to repeat this process of moving along this surface. Right? So starting from here, this is not the optimal solution yet. We want to reach C here, which is the minimum of the whole surface.
So the third line is the second vertical line that you have drawn?
The third line?
Yes. The second.
Yes.
And the red dotted line means what?
Just means when we after we made this decision, we have to start the solver afresh or semi-afresh.
Yeah. Sorry, can you remind me what is the norm, what is the OPJ in the STPP solver?
Sorry, the log?
So if you want to like set it up in the STPP, what we should choose to be the norm, what we should choose to be the objective?
So for navigator setup, the norm should be, objective should be the identity operator and norm should be the navigator block. Sorry? Vice versa?
Or vice versa.
Oh, okay.
I mean, in terms of the Ksi's
are X and Y's. They are variables.
Uh-huh.
The variables are supposed to be solved.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the solver starts X and Y's from a generic value. See, zeros or X and Y's are, capital X, capital Y's are more or less like identity matrix. Okay, and now, thanks for all the questions. And now we can move on to the two variable setup. That is to include the P as a variable of our Lagrangian. So instead of our Lagrangian, instead of as a function of C, it becomes a function of C and P. And now our stationary conditions will be solving two sets of stationary conditions at the same time. The example here is just we demand the stationary solutions in the P space and demand the stationary conditions in the C space. And each time we will take a step not just from not just in C space, but in C and P space. Okay, so that's just a notation. What's being changed? Okay, and here I just wanted to show you like pictorially what is going on. So originally we fix P and we move the solver moves in the C plane, and now it's we are moving in this whole like if you consider this whole line, it will be a line across a 3D surface, like across a 3D space where the XY planes are C and P, and we descend from large mu to small mu. So what this means is each time like we start from some mu and C and P, and we take a step in C and P, and we just keep doing this until we reach the mu equals to zero surface where we are at the solution that solves both the stationary conditions of C and the stationary conditions of P. Yeah.
So do you have derivative information in everywhere in between to make the step?
Yes, we will. And I'll show you like, exactly what they are.
Is it still an SDP problem, or are you changing? I mean,
it's
you're changing the...
So this is what we mean by our dynamical solver. So it's not no longer a standard SDP solver anymore. Yeah.
Is it already in literature or is it something new? I mean,
since we invented the dynamical solver ourselves, it's that we haven't found the exact same problems in the community. But there are I think there are a few related concepts. Yeah. Okay, so now let's start reformulate our problems in this 2D variable case. And again, our ultimate goals will be to either minimize the navigator functions, that's the mu equals to zero surface, or to extremize P in some direction. So extremize P in a direction V. So for this example, minimize the navigator is straightforward. And extremize P in V equals to plus one direction is to maximize delta X sigma.
Sorry, maybe I confused. So is this y-axis the navigator or the Lagrangian?
The Lagrangian for now.
Okay.
So actually I should be drawing the 3D surface. So that it's the Lagrangian is a function of C and P.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll explain later on what those lines are.
Okay.
Yeah. But for now, you can just you can think of it as
the Lagrangian is the same as minimizing n, I guess.
Minimizing the Lagrangian at each mu.
At each P, if I just like keep going, then I solve this problem. I get minimized n, and I got. Minimize the Lagrangian, right?
Fix P and yeah. Minimize, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It is a stationary conditions of just like little chunks. So that's what it's doing.
So sorry, just for notation, the curly N is the navigator function.
Yeah, the curly N is a navigator function that should just be the last line here.
Okay.
Go ahead. The mu's are the first that they are finite mu's, and second they are functions of both P and C. Yeah.
And what is the vector V?
The vector V is some direction you want to extremize P in. So for example, this one is plus one, this one is minus one. If it's 2D, then you can specify whichever direction you want.
So with respect to before you're going all the way down to mu equals zero, and then you choose the direction.
Yeah.
Now the point is you wanna change as you go down. So it's about being more efficient. Or?
are.
Yeah, to avoid some redundancies of like this going down and going up again.
Okay. Is it clear that it's not going to point in the opposite direction compared to like the mu equal to zero?
Good point. Yes, yes, yes. We'll address this problem later.
So UP is the scaling dimensions of external operators?
In general they can be the scaling dimensions and OP coefficients, the physical parameters we care about.
And this is because the positive matrices depend on those parameters, right?
So it's the those vectors and the matrix coefficients in your SDV problem.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So if fixed P, those are constants. Okay, and now really we just naively thinking we just have a two variable optimization problem. So the starting point will be just writing down the stationary conditions in each variable and use the Newton's method to find the updating steps in delta P and delta C. And of course, we can linearize this set of equations by solving so that we can solve delta P and delta C separately.
This is fixed mu.
This is just doing it at each step of mu. So like each time we're at a fixed mu, and next time we're at a new mu, we'll optimize with respect to that new surface again. Yeah. Right, okay, so yeah, so at the end, we'll have some Hessian effective of delta P and gradient effective of delta P. And those are just written down there with a mixed term with C's. Okay, so those are really just high school math. Yes.
Do you currently take the navigator to be your primal objective or dual objective?
My navigator, do you mean the final surface? Or those final?
Yeah, if mu goes to zero, they're the same, right?
Yeah.
If mu is non-zero, then what is your...
When mu is non-zero, you mean what this is?
The navigator function itself, right? So it's defined as like you... Okay, so you choose a normalization, you maximize the dual objective or minimize the primal objective. Right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, and then if mu is non-zero, then like you have two ways, basically.
Yeah, so they will have they're not exactly primal or primal or dual objective. There's some. So it also depends on how you choose your Lagrangian, like a different way to choose your, but ours is, I think it's closer to the primal objective with some error terms. That depends on you. Yeah, good question, actually. It will turn up again at the end of the talk. Okay.
This was explained yesterday, but what does the effective mean, the EFF?
Oh, this is probably not in yesterday's talk. So this I just named those matrices. So those matrices and the gradients just come from diagonalizing those two those two equations, and just separate them out to find independent
equations for delta.
Yeah. Okay, and so the last slides are the equations for minimizing the navigator. And a different problem is to extremize P in certain direction. That means goes to the boundary. At the boundaries, the condition becomes the surface equals to zero. The surface We want to find the solutions at L mu equals to zero, at which L mu equals to zero. And another condition is on the derivatives, on the gradients, where we want the gradients to be perpendicular to the search direction. Okay, and the stationary condition with respect to C is still the same. And then we'll just, again, write down our Newton's updated equations and then solve for delta P. I omitted delta C here, but it's a simple thing here.
Sorry, I didn't get it. Why is the Lagrangian itself need to be zero?
Because it's on the boundary. So, yeah, so it's like, if it's 2D, this is the island, and at the boundary point, this is, if the origin navigator should be n equals to zero, but we are doing the finite mu problem, so we just demand for each mu is zero.
Yeah. All these things work when it's convex. When it's convex in C and convex in P.
Yeah. So if they are not convex, then the Newton's method will point you to the wrong direction. Yes. Okay, and here is question of how we get those derivatives. So to get the derivative, in particular with respect to P, then we need to pick different points in the P space. And each different P will correspond to different sets of those parameters in your STP, meaning we have to, for each different P, we need to compute an STP, recompute the STP for it. So for example, this red dot C is a center where P is at the where it is right now. And to compute those derivatives, we need to sample a few points around it. And using those points, we can compute the using the finite difference to approximate the derivatives. And so we already realized like here if so to compute, in particular to compute HPP, the Hessian matrix respect to P's along, that requires an n square number of STPs. And that is expensive if as dimension of P grows. And so we'll address this problem later. We'll try to avoid it. It's the same, in the same spirit as yesterday, why we want to use BFGS instead of the standard Newton's method. Okay, and just mention it, in the program, the path of those files need to be provided to the solver. Okay. Okay, so that's the most naive setup, just two-direction Newton's method. And now I want to discuss and motivate our algorithm by showing many, many problems that we ran into. And so first of all, as many of you have already noticed, neither the mu equals to zero exact navigator surface nor those L mu surface are guaranteed to be convex in P space. And that means just when we solve Newton's method, it can using Newton's method, it can point in a completely wrong direction. Okay, and furthermore, noticing that C is a very high dimension variable. So it's C stands for all X and Y's and capital X and capital Y's, and they can be vectors of thousands of elements long. And so, that high dimensional, high dimensional vectors, high dimensional matrices can potentially make the solver behave, make the problem even less well-conditioned. And it's hard to probe in that sense. It's hard to imagine a thousands or 10,000 space in your solver. Okay, so that's So that this plot, I just wanted to show you like the surface of L mu. Well, again, here it's not a surface yet, they're just lines, but you can already see the shapes are changing. And at higher mu, it could look considerably different from like the navigator surface at the end. And second problem, in interior point method, yeah, it's a changing mu problem. So Newton's methods originally we always optimize the same, it's the same objective function, but now we're using Newton's method to a function that keeps changing depending on mu. So like even with a fixed surface, like C. A fixed surface like this, Newton's method can miss local structure, only capture the local structure and miss the global structures of a function. And now this function is even changing. So how trustworthy is the quadratic model we constructed to use our Newton's method upon? That's a problem that we need to deal with, to decide whether to decide whether our approximation is trustworthy, and when it's not, what should we do? Okay, so that's just changing mu surface. Okay, and finally, the third point, this is a topic that we touched yesterday as well, that's when the solver stalls. So the solver stalls, we call the solver stalls when the step length alpha becomes too small, and that's this should be a D, so it stands for due, and this P stands for primal. So the primal and due each have their own alphas, and when alpha is very small, that means originally after we calculated dx and dy, and now if we set alpha to 1, then it's possible that we are violating the positive conditions for next step. And so alpha now tells us, no, you can't go that far, please step back. And so the smaller alpha gets, it means the solver, naive Newton's method, we are really stepping outside of the safety zone. So alpha can be an indicator of how close the solver is to the boundary of the positive regions. And we want to stay inside, because when we become too close to the boundary, then the solver can stall and the alpha gets small and we are not effectively moving anywhere. We just keep bumping into the wall. And this barrier function, mu log determinant x, as we mentioned earlier, smooths out the problem, because if you remember, the mu is a barrier term or a penalty term that pushing the solvers into the positive region. So a large mu will penalize this x or y approaching to the boundaries. And so larger mu's will smooth out the problem and push the solver to the interior. And so this stalling problem is more problematic, it's more severe when mu is small, and when mu is large, the problem is, the solver is smoother. Okay. And the next few slides, I want to show some, just pictorially show you in what scenarios like stalling is likely to happen. Okay, so again, I want to explain this plot again. Those dashed lines, those parabolas, I meant to show them perpendicular to the plane. So they are parabolas with respect to C here. And so these two parabolas I'm considering here are fixed to P. And so this is just a standard STB solver scenario. When originally, the solver is up here somewhere, And what you want to do is to find the optimal solutions at the same time of reducing mu, okay? So these two parabolas correspond to mu1 and mu2. And the solver, C mu1 is originally here. And what you want to move is move to the mu2 surface. And at the same time, trying to approach the optimal solution. Okay. And so those red regions, I made them to be the non-positive region. So we always want to stay close, stay inside the positive region.
There are three dots here. There's mu1 and mu2. Which dots are supposed to represent which units?
Four dots here. Okay, so
that's right.
This, yeah.
just the arrow, like the C mu1 to C mu2, which is that just the arrow that's on the top two dots?
Sorry, this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this arrow, I originally draw it on the top mu level. So if C mu is fixed, then the stationary solution should just go there.
Okay, so the rule that's at the top of the plot, that one is supposed to be the second and third dots.
Yeah, the red the curvy line. Yes. Yeah. Okay, and now this is a scenario when the last slide it was this second parabola. Now it's a third parabola. Why did I draw a third parabola? I just wanted to show like when we are moving, like decreasing mu really dramatically. So going from the first parabola to the third parabola. And it's likely that we just overshoot to the negative regions. And what alpha does is it says, okay, you are in a bad region now. So step back, I'll scale these steps to a smaller step. So you stay in the positive regions at a less dramatic decrease. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so that's what alpha does. And this is a scenario that when at fixed p, but decreasing mu either too dramatically can like kick us out of the positive region. And now, switching to the scenario that we're both changing mu and p, that's this step. So what are those two lines? So those two lines are first, they're decreasing, and so different mu's. And we're changing p as well, OK? And so now, again, negative regions, positive regions. So there's just more danger, more risk that with both p and mu changing, that will be kicked out of the positive regions. So what I want to show, what I want to tell you here is that even at fixed p, decreasing mu can lead to problems of this stalling problems. And now with both p and mu changing, it becomes more severe for us. Like fixed p's, you sometimes run it. Maybe some of you have run it, but it's not like happened very frequently. But for us, if we don't have special techniques, it just appears over and over again. It's kind of disastrous. Okay, and now I'll move on to proposing our solutions to those different problems. And so though there are major three inventions in our algorithm. The first one called centering, and the motivation is the justification is that centering helps us to stay within the positive regions to avoid stalling. And the scanning is to construct some trustworthy approximations to our keep changing targeted function.
Sorry, centering is this stepping back that you were mentioning before?
I will discuss what they mean exactly. Yeah. Here I just want to list them. Yeah. And the third one is a modified BFGS algorithm. and it's motivated by both avoid the expense of computing the HPP and also to avoid some EO conditional problems of the Hessian matrix. Okay, so now let's move on to the details. So okay, so this plot is what center means. So centering is we mean by we're prioritizing the stationary conditions of C. So that means at each fixed mu and fixed p, we'll first move down to the optimal solutions of this point. That's this point. So originally we're jumping here to the next surface, but now we'll first move down to the stationary solutions at fixed mu and fixed p, and then we jump from there. And when we take that jump, it's very unlikely that we can stay at the stationary solution. So instead, we'll be shoot up again a little bit. But the centering step will prioritizing of this optimization first before we jump again. Okay, so that's we'll always do this. Like we'll always repeat this procedure first to reach those points. Okay. Okay, and more or less intuition behind this strategy is that when so avoid stalling, meaning that we want to stay in the center of the positive region as close as possible. So stay inside is safer. And the stay inside, meaning the current value of C is sufficiently close to the optimal solution. And this closeness, this distance between the current value and the stationary solution is measured by the R arrow. And there are different measures we can choose from the R arrow, but here we just choose the trace of the matrix. So that's so R characterizes how well we are solving the optimal conditions at finite mu. Okay, question here? Okay, so this is the actual algorithm. First, centering is this bit, only this bit. So this is a whole algorithm with an initial Xi and P and the output Xi and P. So the first block is just to descend to some of the kind of some reliable first line of the navigator function, sorry, of the finite, of the Lagrangian. So that will correspond to like the, for example, this first blue line here. Because if we really start at the, say, mu equals to 2, 10 to the 40s, then the curve will be too crazy to deduce any reliable information. Okay, yeah, so for the first step is just to descend down to a surface that is more or less informative. And then the second block is just when we find the solution, we find the solution. So we just output. That's just a check. And then if now, if we pass the first two blocks, then it's reached the decision block of whether we want to do centering. And the criterion is that whether the R arrow is much, much less than one. And if it is, then we go to the next step. If it's not, then we will keep doing centering. And centering will bring us close to the stationary solution where R is small. Okay. And so we don't expect the centering happen for too many times, but I'll mention at the end of when centering can fail. We don't expect it. We expect it to take a constant number of times. So
your first step is actually descend to the center of to satisfy stationary condition for both.
No. Just the usual STPB. So usually STPB you will solve until mu is equals to zero, right? Here we are just descend to see maybe mu equals to 10 to the negative 4 or 5-ish.
Okay, but yeah. You require the peak side to be,
Yeah, it's keep solving it the same, yeah. Okay, and here is a plot that, so here I want to show you that our actual path that the algorithm is taking is indeed very close to the stationary point at each mu and p. So let me explain this. So the x-axis is still delta xc, that's the p. And the vertical axis is a log duality gap. And if you remember, gap is behave more or less like mu. When as mu equals, goes to zero, the gap should go to zero as well. And we decrease mu's by a constant factor each time. Okay, and those dots are stationary solutions. Hey, just we just solve it exactly at particular mu and particular p. And the skydiving path is the path that our solver is taking. And you can see like, the path stays relatively close to the actual stationary solutions. That's it, just right here. Okay. Okay, so that's the centering steps. Any questions on centering steps? Okay. Then the next routine we use is called the scanning. And let me first motivate what problems we are dealing with here. So at each iteration, we have a new mu surface, let me draw a plot here. So let's see, we are at some mu one surface, and we will decide mu two as some say. Decreasing mu one by a ratio, and we have two surfaces. And originally we were at here, and we will first to decide which surface we want to move next, and then we compute dxc and dp to exactly move to that point. And now we make this decision of the step based on the quadratic models that we constructed from those derivatives. But the question is now, how trustworthy is this quadratic model? Okay, so first of all, now finally we can come to a 2D plane. That's because after centering, we are sufficiently close to the local optimal solutions, which is a function of mu and p. So now our 2D space is reduced to 2D problems instead, as each of the finite mu surfaces are defined as such. And the mu equals to zero surface is the navigator functions that you are familiar with. Okay, so that's just explaining of the plot. And now let's look at this scenario. When we were originally at this point, we need to decide which point to jump next. And the way we make that decision is to first decide which surface we want to move next, and then make this step. Okay, and here the purple arrow and purple dot, and the red arrow and the red dot are two choices of those target mu surface. So you can see the purple surface is relatively close to where we are right now. And because it's relatively close, then our local information based on here give us a pretty good approximation of the new mu surface. So that's a trustworthy model. And if instead we're decreasing mu two dramatically, and we decrease it until here, but all the local information we have are still from this blue line, so that could mean that our predicted model is significantly different from the actual curves, and that is what I mean by a not so trustworthy model. And a not so trustworthy model can lead us to taking a wrong step. And so the criterion of whether we are taking a good step or not, or whether our model is trustworthy or not, is given by the step length alpha as a criteria. So when the logic goes like so. So when alpha is big enough, then our solver is not stalling. And when our solver is not stalling, we're taking a good step. Taking a good step means that our model is trustworthy at the current stage. So that's why I draw the arrows, the length of arrows differently. Because the smaller alpha gets, then the arrow gets shrinks, and that means the solver really doesn't want to take this step because we give it a bad prediction. Okay. So that's putting into the algorithm. So this is the scanning algorithms, the scanning subroutines. So what it does is we want to probe those different arrows, and different arrows correspond to different mu surface. And the way we do it is to scan the different mu surface. So what we do is we start from an initial beta, and when say beta is less than one, we choose it to scan up to beta equals to one. And for each mu, we'll compute our steps and then compute our step length. And if the step length is great, big enough, that means we're really in a good shape. So we just return the steps. It's everything in good shape, we're happy. But if it's not, then we say, oh, okay, this mu is probably too small. Then we will increase our beta and do this iterations again. And when beta is already, we're already at our surface, like beta equals to one, then we are at exactly where we are now. We're not decreasing anywhere. Then we just take a second look, choose the best alpha we get. That's the largest alpha, the best step we can possibly we get from the scanning procedures. And let's consider a bit if a second criteria is all right, it's not too bad, then we'll return yes, we'll take that step. If it even fails that second criteria, then okay, not in a good place, let's increase beta. That means increasing mu. So that will, instead of going down, we're going up a little bit. And so that's a way of solving kind of a current stalling problem of increasing mu, of escaping a dangerous area. That's basically it. And at the same time, we'll give up with updating p at the same time. So it's just, this is really a kind of a risking plan. When we're already kind of dangerous, then let's escape first before we want to explore the parameter space again. Okay, so that's scanning subroutines. And any question here? No. Okay.
Increase beta or decrease beta? Do you multiply by some constant factor?
So yeah, here those beta means and the steps will be input parameters from the users. You can even decide.
This increase beta thing, right? So you start to say with something 0.3 or 0.1, and then
yeah. So exactly. So the current algorithm starts from beta mean equals to 0.1,
yeah.
And each time increase by 0.1.
Oh, adding.
Yeah, it's adding. Yeah. But potentially there can be more sophisticated updating plans. Yeah. Okay, and this is an example of doing scanning with the increase strategies and not increasing the strategy. So the yellow line here is just we scan from a beta mean to beta equals to one, and we didn't allow it to increase. And the purple line does allow that to happen. And you can see those little dots are the little steps. Can you see? It's a little step the solver is taking. And you can see for the one that doesn't allow the solver to increase mu, doesn't allow to escape from the current mu surface, then the steps are really, really tiny. So it's getting stuck there. Like alpha is small and so on. But comparing to the one that's allowed it to lift it a little bit and escape the dangerous areas, then the step size are considerably better.
Okay. Is that it can even move, I guess.
Yeah, this one is a better one. This is a Tinder example.
What is the going back up? How does that metaphor work for skydiving? What is the skydiving?
You should probably carry an engine with you. Okay, so that's just summing up the whole algorithm again. And the scanning subroutine you just saw comes into here. Okay. And here is an example of what the solver, the path of the solver actually takes. First thing I want to say is the 1D example is really not this terrible. This surface, if you notice, is slightly different from the ones we saw before. If I give you some comparisons, you see, it's smooth here, but this one, it gets some local structures here. So these surfaces are what we cooked up later on for a different problem. But I show this plot here because it exactly shows that when the solver gets into trouble, how the algorithm is helping it to escape from that those troubles. So the solver gets on here and first goes to the minimum that's really far away from the actual minimum at mu equals to zero. And then it gets trapped on a different surface at the local minimum. It really tries to get down there until it realizes by some like mu alpha criterion, it realizes it's in trouble. So it climbs up, climbs down, climbs up, and then it reaches a different local minimum. But again, this local minimum is not the final minimum that we want to reach. So after a while, it realizes, oh, wrong path again. And then it climbs again and finally reaches the correct optimal solution. So my office mate at Caltech told me this is like the life path of grad students. That's probably an optimistic estimation. Okay, so that's finished the scanning algorithm. And finally, the third major chunk of our algorithm is to use a modified BFGS algorithm that's different from the standard one. And the motivations of using BFGS at the beginning is that, again, this matrix is very expensive to compute. And so our quasi-Newton's method will reduce the On squared complexity to On. And secondly, since the finite mu surface, they are not guaranteed to be well-behaved, well, even the mu equals to zero surface is not guaranteed. So when the exact Hessian matrix is ill-conditioned, then it's better to just use the gradient information so that we know that we want to go lower along the path, along the curve.
Can we see the last slide again?
Yeah.
So the step lengths or the beta parameter, does that have some amount of inertia? Because I can see that it goes up twice or three times in a row. It doesn't try to go back down immediately.
Yeah.
How does the algorithm decide that it's going to keep going up instead of turning around immediately?
So every climbing will be decided by the alpha parameters. So it's like, say here, say in the middle here, a computer alpha is really small, then it climbs a little bit, but it climbs up only by setting, say, beta equals to 2. So climb up by, say, from mu to 2 times mu. And that might not be enough to lift it, for it to escape from the dangerous region, dangerous negative region. At that point, we'll calculate alpha again. We find it's still small, so we decide to climb up again.
So why is it that it it doesn't realize that it needs to turn around earlier? Like if you consider a race where it turns around, there's quite a few points around that region, which means that it keeps going down and keeps going up. So
yeah. So I think this is because we had a hard cutoff on the alphas. So like, for example, we set we set these parameters, like the OK parameters, to be 0.1-ish. And 0.1 really isn't that good. Like, it's 0.1 is kind of dangerous. It's just not catastrophic. So by that cutoff, we might not be able to stop that going down tendencies fully. Yeah.
So each time you, I guess the most expensive part of this computation is to like compute the Newton step length.
Well, like reading, yes, but inverting isn't that bad. Let me think a little. What we usually do is we first take the kind of the SDPB standard step to compute like the X inverse part, which in our case will be the CC inverse part. And so that's expensive, but that's like just one of the standard procedures that we can't avoid. And after that, let's see. Yeah, we'll involve another inverse, but that inverse, so the other inverse is after, like, so this part will enter the PP effective. And we need to take inverse of that.
Yeah.
But because P is really low dimension, so this doesn't take much time.
Yeah.
And then I'll see in this plot, so up there we've kind of already calculated DC and DP. Alpha DC is expensive because it involves this inverse again. Sorry, my blackboard planning is really terrible.
So you take like your X, Y matrix and add it like DC, and then you, isn't alpha just kind of like setting up the boundary? Yeah. Oh, that is expensive? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because you need the eigenvalues. You need minimum eigenvalues.
Oh,
that's expensive.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you basically, I guess this is unavoidable, but if you choose beta min to be 0.1, and then like each time you increase by 1, and then in the upward, it's really kind of you have to do it 10 times.
Yeah. So it's so potentially there are like either we can choose other strategies, like we don't do equal distance steps, or we don't have to scan that many. Like there can be rougher scans or finer scans only in some subregions that you want to probe. Yeah. So it's definitely something like I hope we all try. So to give away what I always think and what Ying and I always think in this algorithm is that sometimes the most rigorous strategies doesn't work the best. It's some sketchy strategies that tends to have a better performance. So
like path of aggressive.
Good to know.
So if computing this minimum eigenvalue is very crucial, it's like one of the bottlenecks.
Yeah.
What algorithm do you use to do that? Do you use Lanchos or something else?
I'm not sure which one it's used in Elemental. Yeah, I'm not sure actually. But I think it's still a cube complexity manipulation.
Also, maybe this is too high level, but all of the stuff you're telling us about now, you wrote in Haskell code, right?
No, this was in C++.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the skydiving release branch you compiled from the SDPB library. Yeah.
how do you generally, when you're controlling these things with Haskell, how do you keep a good, disconnect where the Haskell isn't taking too much of the time required to run?
Oh, Haskell is really just an interface that we fit in the parameters. The majority of those algorithms all takes place in C++, and all the calculation takes place in C++. Okay, and now getting back to BFGS. So this I just write down the standard BFGS set. We use the gradient informations and the step lengths from k-1 to k, and the gradient from k-1 to k, and update the Hessian matrix by a rank one correction. Okay. And now the problem. So let's just focus on the second line here. So what BFGS does is it's dealing with one objective functions, and it has two points. And it uses these two points and their respective gradient informations to update your Hessian matrix. Our problem, we get the gradients up here and the gradients down here. So we get gradients from different surfaces. And that is incompatible with what standard BFGS does. And what we need to do is to take the information we have at a different surface and somehow interpolate it down to the lower surface. Okay. So that's what I've written down here. Yep. Sorry, extrapolate, not interpolate. Okay. And right, so we want to get from this black arrow to this red arrow. Use this red arrows and the other black arrow to get to model some quadratic surface that we hope is close enough to the actual black surface here. Okay. And so I print out the calculation here as well, but the takeaway is, this red arrow here is exactly the gradient effective that I showed you from almost the very beginning. So that gradient effective, the extra piece carries these arrows down to the next surface. Okay. And one more step is say. With the last slides, we get to the target surface, like we hope to arrive. But remember, our alpha will shrink. Like the alpha will, if alpha is not 1, if it's 1, then we're fine. We're at the target surface we want to arrive at. But if alpha is not 1, then we need to move, that telling us we're moving up. So this little alpha will needs to enter our approximations to the gradients at the actual surface we're arriving at. So that's the alpha just comes in here as a scaling of what additions we're putting here to interpolate from the to extrapolate from the black arrow to the red arrow. Okay. Okay, so that's modified BFGS. And so the three major routines I just told you apply to both the minimization mode and the extremizing mode to find the boundaries. And what I'm going to discuss in the next few slides are specifically targeted for the extremizing scenario. And the problem is here, our finite mu surface it's not guaranteed to have a zero. Because we descend from high above, then what should we do when the surface is not even negative? Like at this point, what should our search goal is? And then, so it's the most naive thinking, which, well, the only thing that seems possible is just to go to the minimum. So our design is just, we start the algorithm by minimizing, go to the minimum of the finite mu surface until our current point becomes negative. That's we know at least our function has a negative region. And then we switch to this mode of finding the boundary. Okay, but this proposed problems too. And this problem is that we will, if the surface is really flat, like those gray curve I draw here, if it's flat, then we might face a dramatic jump from the minimum to the boundary, and a big jump is dangerous for any like this iterative updating method, as it can corrupt our quadratic model's reliability a lot. So big jump meaning it can lead to stalling, but it's not something we can really avoid. But remember, so we probably have to jump at some point, and the mu story tells us since mu smooths the problem, so if we have to jump, let's jump as early as possible. So we want to jump when at a larger mu surface, and the first the most natural way coming to mind is to equate it with a constant term that's proportional to mu but does not depend on x and y's. So that's the plot here. So instead of waiting this curve to reach the zeros, we will solve those black points instead. So that black points will correspond to the shifted Lagrangian. So for these scenarios, we'll start to we are already searching for the boundaries at the mu 1 surface. Unlike earlier, we have to wait until the mu surface touches the x-axis. Okay, so that is just an effort towards jumping as early as possible. But what we've any questions here?
Lambda constant or is lambda?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Lambda is the constant you choose, customer chosen value. Yeah, and yeah, and by the way, you asked the difference, is our finite mu Lagrangian approximating the primal objective or the dual objective? So in the Lagrangian we are choosing, it's approximating the primal objective much closer than the dual objective. So this lambdas kind of takes the average. So it's kind of like this. And after adding this lambda, we're taking the average between the two curves. Yeah. Thank you.
The number you called a big jump was 1 part in 10,000.
Don't even know how to reply here. Living a small world. Okay, and and now I'm telling you that big jump, that small jump, even not that small yet. What I'm saying. Anyway, okay, so after adding that constant term, what we notice is that it doesn't solve the problem completely. That meaning we're still not jumping as early as possible. And we still stall, and we observe that the term, the original mu log determinant terms in the Lagrangians is a magnitude bigger than the constant shift we added. So this is kind of an experimental, like natural thing. We'll just get rid of it. So this finding solutions to these equations instead of that is basically taking that log term away from the Lagrangian. But because now this term depends on x, meaning our Lagrangians, we take an x dependence term from our Lagrangian, then our surface, the shape of our surface will change. It's not a constant shift anymore. So that's the kind of catastrophic, kind of terrible curves we saw earlier when the solver does the crazy things. As the shape will change and it becomes less smooth compared to the Lagrangian with the log term, it develops some local minimums, local structures. But on the other hand, we see this blue curve does decrease to the zero surface much earlier than before. So now here is the dilemma. The dilemma is it's not jumping. Oh, it's jumping. Sorry. Okay, so the dilemma is the curve with the log term in the Lagrangian is smoother, but it's high above. A good thing about the Lagrangian without log term, it has local structures, but it starts the jumping earlier at larger mu's. So this blue curve, this blue path here, is the one that following. That blue curve is just by solving those curves, and you can see it's doing something. It's following the local minimum, and it's not trying to reach the other side early enough. So it gets stuck at some local structures. And I've told you there's some kind of a dilemma of trade-off between the Lagrangian with the log term and without the log term. Then the strategy we finally take is to mix those two. That is, the good thing about the Lagrangians with log term is that it has good shapes. And good shape mean, in terms of derivatives, that means we want the gradients are the better gradients. But on the other hand, the Lagrangian without the log term has a better kind of level. So we mix these two by assuming that our Lagrangian is our Lagrangian, the level is, sorry, the value itself takes those points, but the gradients we take from the Lagrangians with the log term. So that's what this orange curve is taking. It's following the shape of the Lagrangian with the log term. But when it makes the decision, when it wants to search the boundary mode, or search for the minimum, it makes that decision based on the Lagrangian without the log term. Okay. It's kind of confusing. And of course, this strategy is, by default, this choice is the default choice for the solver. But you can explore by turning those conditions on and off, and following the Lagrangians both with the values and with the gradients, following the Lagrangians with the log term using both the level, the value, and the gradients, or following the Lagrangian without log term, following both the values and the gradients, or mix them up, like you can try all four combinations and see which behaves better.
Does it happen when you, like, so say that you start with like searching for the minimum, and then at some point it decides to go for the boundary, and then when it's trapped, it goes up, and it goes back up to like kind of a decide, finding the minimum and back and forth. Does it happen?
Yeah. You mean
switch mode?
It happens a little bit, but not that much. And so also, it's in practice. It doesn't happen. It's not stuck in there doing that forever. So let's see. I can only say, by principle, that could happen,
yeah.
But empirically, it didn't happen.
Okay,
so that finished my full descriptions of the most important bits. additions to the algorithm. And now I'll show you some results. All right, so this is what you will see when you run the skydiving algorithm. So this is the first step that decreased to the relatively low mu level. That's the first step. And what it does, those fours are the centering iterations. So this means like at the first, 18 step at least, like each time centering happens four times. And and then it just goes on. And the scanning's algorithm hidden inside there. Yeah, and this is a search in of the Ising Island with sigma epsilon, and it's scanning the full three parameters, delta sigma, delta epsilon, and the OPE angle. And here is the duality gap, okay. And this is, this is a different scans on the O3 tip top search. So the tip top search, it's an 8-parameter search, including three external parameters, external operators, and the additional T4 gap. So let me just write it down. So those are the external parameters, and with an additional T4 gap, it's the scaling dimension scan and the plus four OPE coefficient scan. So that's an 8-dimension. Here I draw 3D diagrams. So this one is a path in the delta psi, delta, that's T4, delta T4, and delta S parameter space. And it's like going up here from here, like winding up. That's just a path, but the other plots I find more, probably more illustrative. So this, the z-axis is the log of the duality gap. So you can see the duality gap, like at first it's kind of high above, and then it has a few climbing, descending, and finally it goes down. So this is where the solution actually lands. It's kind of skydiving, okay. And here are some like the tables of some run we tried. The first two you can run it in Hyperion. The last two examples run those two. Okay. So you can we will see later in the afternoon like how they function. And I put down so those are lambda equals to 11, and both 3-dimensional search. And the first one minimizing navigator, second one maximizing delta sigma. And it really gets along to about 30 digits. I just didn't want to screw my slides, but it really gets along very long. And yeah, and the third and the fourth rows are the O3 tip top search. And it happens at lambda 19 and 35. And those are 8-dimensional search. And those are the the data we get at the end. And the last line is a previous O3 tip top search by scanning the region, basically doing the disallowed and allowed scanning. And so this is the upper bound that reached in that paper. I should have put the reference here, but yeah, let me make it up later. I'll get better results.
Wow.
Yes?
What is the second to last line lower precision?
I will show you. It's just because they are reached at different duality gaps. So we haven't run this until gap is small enough.
Okay.
This error, is it an island error bar as in that's the dimension of the island, or is it another error? In the delta T4 calculation with tip top.
Second last line.
That one.
This one.
That error bar there, what is it?
It's just I look at our final few iterations, and the first those digits already stabilized.
So it's not like the rigorous error bar.
No, not yet. Yeah.
So I got the delta T4 for the tip tops. That's the upper bound of T4, right?
Yeah.
I see. And then the uncertainty is the uncertainty in the upper bound.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Well, so our upper bound, because those are.
This is the value of the tip, right? So
it's. Yeah. So it's. It's supposed. Okay. That's a really bad joy. So I think it's something like this. This is a tip top.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're just in this region, because we're searching the boundary. So it can be positive, negative, like it's switching.
I have a question. So in your last few steps, like when this, so in the end, basically you just like decrease mu and the parameters not stop changing and you just go straight down.
Yeah.
And in that those steps, if you just like take beta to be like 10 to the minus 10, then would it stall or would it just go fine?
That we haven't tried. Good question. I think it would be relatively safe, but why don't we do it in standard SDBB2?
Wait.
Oh, you did.
You told me that very end you can set beta to be very small and it works. But you have to wait until the direct gap to below 10 to minus 20.
Yes.
If that is very small, you can take beta to be small.
But
that happens in standard SDBB. There is an option for the feasibility centering beta and the infeasibility centering beta. One set to 0.3, another one is 0.1.
Yeah. Like towards the very end, you just like take beta to be pretty much zero.
Yeah.
And we can even like see. Make it changing with a duality gap. Instead of just a 0.3 and 0.1 switch, we have like gradually doing 0.1 and point like 10 to the negative 2, 10 to the negative 3, and go on.
Yeah, at that level, I think it's pretty much just like Newton's solution, like trying to use Newton's method and solve for the extremal function.
Yeah.
Right, so.
Yeah. Good point. Okay, and so here are some more like which duality gap they are those last slides results are reached at, and like some preset precision that's a working precision that the solver takes, and the CPU hours. So we had a few estimates. The first two takes. Like I ran it on 16 cores and it takes 3 hours to finish. And the tip tops are considerably like more expensive. And so, right, so you can, so a few takeaway here is, especially comparing the last two lines. So our algorithm can function at a much lower precision, but you can see like our results is, can. Is reaching a precision higher than the our digits gets longer than the previous result. And secondly, so we have an estimate of how like our CPU hours and their CPU hours reported in the paper. And and another thing to mention is so for this 84,000 CPU hours. They are divided into two parts. One part is what the solver consumes, and the other part is what the SDP consumes, generating the SDP files. So it used to be that the bottleneck happens at the solver stage. But you can see now the bottleneck moves from the solvers to just generating those files. And at least parallelizing the stage of generating files is much easier than parallelizing the solver stage. So that's one advantage. And also, among those CPU hours the solver takes, a third of it comes out from just reading files. So we do expect that there are optimization we can still achieve there. Okay, and this last plot is it's just number of iterations. Like the first iteration is really high. It's just a standard SDP that descending to a trustworthy mu surface, and the rest are like relatively small. So they mainly consists of the centering steps, and the centering steps also decrease at the end. Okay, and limitino. Sorry, it's just so there are a few limitations of our algorithm, and one of the major one is the centering steps. When the centering steps fail to reduce R, so the problem we mentioned, Ning mentioned yesterday, when the solver fails the Slater conditions, that's kind of we have a flat direction thing. That case, we have trouble reducing R. So the R just never, just R characterizes how well we are solving xy equals mu I. And with the flat conditions, there's just an R that we can never reduce. And that is a problem. And we hope to solve it for like future project. Okay, so that's it. And thank you very much.